This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In Charlotte, banking put us on the map. The presence of Bank of America and Wachovia were jewels in our crown, but when the banking sector experienced a meltdown, one of those jewels simply disappeared, while the other one, the one that remained, was badly damaged. We thought the worst was behind us, but that may not be true. Matt Taibbi, a national columnist, wrote two articles in Rolling Stone magazine alleging that Bank of America has defrauded everyone from investors and insurers to homeowners and the unemployed, and asking not if they were too big to fail, but if they were too crooked to do so. That was in March. In May, Taibbi returned with an article detailing a list of problems that raised questions about the bank's future. So we've asked two local reporters to join us this hour to examine all of this and more, and to provide a perspective on the banks and banking that they've gleaned from covering the topic closely over the past several years. Rick Rothacker joined Reuters as a banking reporter in 2011, and prior to that he held a similar post and won awards for his coverage of banking at the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Adam O'Daniel is the finance editor for the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you for joining us again.
Thank you.
And Tony Plath. Dr. Tony Plath is the banking professor at UNC Charlotte and spent a career in banking before he began to teach others about this. And welcome back to you as well.
Thanks, Mike. Good to be here.
Let's begin with Moody's. You just said off the air that this came out in the Wall Street Journal on Saturday. It was just in the news this morning in our paper here and in USA Today that Moody's Investor Service has lowered its rankings on Bank of America, with 14 of the largest banks in the world as well. It said Bank of America is one of several banks that has had trouble with risk management or a history of high volatility. Compared to other banks, it lacks stable business that can act as shock absorbers to mitigate the volatility of capital markets. What does that all mean?
It means there's a lot of uncertainty in the capital markets with respect to what's going on in Western Europe, particularly in Spain and Italy. We all know the problems that Greece has had. In addition, there is profit softening going on in the U.S. because interest rates are essentially declining, which cuts their profitability. So at the end of the day, we're in an uncertain economic environment. Growth is slowing. Unemployment's likely to remain high. We heard the Fed say that a few days ago. So as a consequence, Moody's has decided that the profit picture for banks is weakening in 2012 and likely to remain that way in 2013. That called for a downgrade.
What has been the reaction from Bank of America and the other banks that have been downgraded?
Well, the banks have actually, some of them have kind of pushed back and said, you're looking backwards, you're looking at things that happened years ago. We've made a lot of strides improving our capital, improving our liquidity. You're not taking that into account. And so you saw a little bit of a pushback there. The banks, this has been something that's been brewing since February, so the banks had time to prepare. Analysts knew it was coming. The stock market knew it was coming as a matter of how far they were going to be downgraded. And Moody's itself, if you think back to the financial crisis, they were the ones rating subprime mortgage bonds as AAA. So there's been also been some criticism. Well, what do these guys really know? But it does say, like Tony said, there's a lot of uncertainty about Europe. Trading, things can go wrong. And so these are the banks that are the biggest in this type of business.
And hasn't Brian Moynihan been doing things for 6 months or so, or maybe even longer than that, to prepare the bank for this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the bank has been working to boost its capital levels, improve liquidity. And so, you know, like Rick said, the bank said, look, we've been preparing for this. And Moody's even said yesterday that we acknowledge that Bank of America has taken some positive steps.
I think the scary thing behind all of this, though, is if profits are diminished and cut, what that means is we're likely to see more job cuts. We're likely to see a lower rate of hiring. We're likely to see more selective lending, all of the things that we don't want to happen in this economy. So, you know, I think a lot of people say, who cares when a downgrade occurs? But it's important because essentially it's going to change the behavior of the banks in other aspects of their business, particularly hiring and lending.
Standard & Poor's came under attack when they downgraded the United States. I think.
They did.
What are we to take from these rating agencies? Because they seem to be asleep at the wheel during much of the lead up to the financial crisis in 2008.
Determining credit quality is an uncertain business. Trying to figure out whether a company is likely to default on its obligations or is highly likely to repay is getting to be a difficult endeavor just because the economy is so uncertain and has been weak for so long.
So Moody's, the rating on Bank of America's long-term senior debt was lowered by Moody's one notch to BAA2 from BAA1. The heck does that mean?
Gets to be a little bit of gobbledygook after a while trying to figure this out. But essentially, they're a couple notches above a junk rating, which obviously isn't the best.
And that doesn't mean they're stuck, does it? Or it just means their
credit
rating.
This is the debt they issue.
Okay.
You know, it speaks in general the credit worthiness of the company.
These would be bonds that they're issuing?
They're rating the bonds. And it gives you a general sense of, you know, what's the credit worthiness of these guys? What are the ability to repay? And how much should be expecting out of these banks going forward? So it just kind of sets the bar for expectations, and there's probably some catch up going of, you know, were they too highly rated in the past, and now we're kind of bringing everybody back in and sort of comprehensively putting everyone in their spot. And they even kind of did a ranking where here's sort of the top tier of banks, here's the middle tier, here's the third tier. Bank of America made it in the third tier.
Wells Fargo came through this unscathed.
Yeah, they did, because
why?
They don't have the capital markets exposure that Bank of America does, that Citi does, that JPMC does. We talked about the $2 billion loss a few weeks ago.
Does the capital exposure that Bank of America has come through Merrill Lynch? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, much of it. Remember, we're talking about underwriting securities, rendering fairness opinions, doing valuation analyses, all of that stuff.
When Bank of America bought Merrill Lynch, when they were painting the rosy picture that Merrill Lynch would bring them, they said that it would give them exposure all over the world in the capital markets.
That's
because
correct.
They have offices in Europe.
Remember,
now, yesterday I read that they're in negotiations with some major bank in Sweden, I think, to buy the European Merrill Lynch division.
But remember, that business is a really volatile business. I mean, when times are good, you make a lot of money. But, you know, when times aren't good, the risk that you'll lose money is more substantial. So there's more franchise risk in a bank that has a big investment bank connected to it than there is with the separation of commercial and investment banking. That's what Glass-Steagall was all about.
Yeah, in this sense, I mean, Merrill obviously did give them this more exposure to Europe than they had before, and Asia, but some of those are the markets that are growing as well.
Or they were.
Yeah, and the piece they're looking to shed is they're looking to get rid of the kind of the wealth management piece overseas, which is kind of brokerage, not kind of private banking level, but around that area. So that's not been a real money-making business for them, so they're kind of reining into the U.S. a little bit on that.
Why isn't wealth management where the real money is? It surely can't be. The real money can't be in checking accounts and passbook savings accounts.
Certainly in the U.S., that's their focus, is getting more affluent customers who have more money to spend and more services are willing to buy. This piece overseas just was not, they didn't stack up competitively.
They were not a major player in that industry. Mm-hmm. They didn't have the scale that they have in wealth in the United States. And so essentially Brian's strategy is to gain profitability by being large and dominant in a business. They weren't dominant in European wealth.
Meanwhile, yesterday it was announced that Merrill Lynch had been fined for overcharging their wealth management customers, essentially those with managed accounts, fee-based managed accounts. And they won't reveal yet what the fine is, but were those overcharges, which I think they have to pay back to their customers, did they occur prior to the Bank of America's acquisition of Merrill Lynch or after? Do we know?
I've not paid real close attention to that one, but that's routinely you'll see, you know, FINRA and other agencies, you know, this kind of stuff happens and it racks
it happen?
Up over
Everything
time.
Is done by computer. How can it happen unless it's deliberate?
And that's what they're blaming it on, was that it was a computer glitch.
How? Come on.
And to answer your first question, I think it was over a number of years, so it probably began when it was Merrill Lynch was a separate company and then crossed over into B of A's ownership.
You were in banking. Can it really be a computer? This is all these people do is deal with numbers. Can it really be a computer glitch?
It depends on the nature of the problem, but you know, my answer to that, if you want a direct answer, mm-hmm. is no, because you've got people that have oversight over the computers and monitor the systems.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, people are ultimately responsible for everything. No.
Also comes from people not checking their monthly statements, I suppose. Let's go back, because all of this downfall in banking and the downfall of the economy was precipitated in large part by these big banks merging and growing and becoming bigger, and also the mortgage sector that they acquired and exploited, I guess, is a good way to say
it. It was motivated by debt, and all of us had a role mm-hmm. in, you know, causing asset prices to get out of control. Borrowers that bought more house than they could afford, lenders that made loans they shouldn't have made, guarantee agencies that rendered risk guarantees on these loans they never should have made. I mean, it's a fairly complicated problem, but when you dig to the bottom of the hole, what you find is we all were too addicted to debt. debt.
Okay, but banks made those bad loans.
And the borrowers took those loans out.
In spite of their better judgment, because why? They wanted to grow?
Part of it was growth. Part of it was a search for profitability. Part of it was we convinced ourselves that real estate prices never go down. Well, you know, they do. I mean, the physics of finance is that asset prices can go down. And when you get into a speculative borrowing market where people over-lever, that's likely to happen. I mean, that's been happening since the 15th century.
We live in a city that was the beneficiary of the growth of Bank of America.
Indeed.
Let's call it NCNB and First Union into the Bank of America and Wachovia and what is now Wells Fargo. And as Hugh McCall, who ran Nations Bank and NCNB and then the Bank of America, and Ed Crutchfield, who did First Union Wachovia for a while. I think he was gone by Wachovia, wasn't he?
Sure.
But
that's correct.
It was a race to the finish between the two of them, and we benefited because all this development along Tryon Street and elsewhere in the city is a result of those two men building their banks and building the city simultaneously. So
yeah,
it's hard for us to look at big banks and say that they're bad things.
That's a thing for Charlotte. It's been this, you know, big positive thing, a source of pride, and then obviously put us in the middle of, you know, the world's economic problems.
But things didn't – I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that's why this has been so difficult for Charlotte these past few years, kind of for our psyche. You know, I covered the Bank of America annual meeting recently, and there's 500 protesters in the street. And as you talk to a lot of those folks, most of them were from out of town. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that people in Charlotte aren't upset about what's happened. You know, there's people here who've had their homes foreclosed or have been laid off by one of the banks. But like you said, we've also benefited from this rise. So it's kind of – and we know these people. We work with people at the bank. We know they're good, genuine people, good neighbors. And so it's kind of this really difficult place where we realize as a city things got out of control. Some banks did some things that led to really negative consequences. Yet we also benefited from the run-up to that.
Even so, if you're not in banking, look at the change in household income, you know, in Mecklenburg County and the surrounding area over the course of the last 20 years. It's been phenomenal. It's been unprecedented in American history. And so even if you're not a banker or you're not connected to the industry, you've benefited from this rise in household income associated with bank consolidation.
Back up for a second. Have in other words, has my income grown because the banks were getting
because
bigger?
Because you have more listeners.
That's not how this works in public radio.
You have more contributors.
No, I'm dead serious, but that's not how it works. It works that way in commercial radio. That's not how this works. But has my income, has the average person, does the street cleaner's income gone up because of Bank of America? Has average household income gone up because banks have brought in more high-paid employees?
Well, that's why it's gone up directly. But remember, those high-paying employees are also spending a lot of money on the theater. They're spending money on buying cars. They're spending money contributing to National Public Radio. So all of the above are true. There's a multiplier effect associated with spending.
You want to add anything?
No,
to that?
I was just no. I agree with what Tony say. I mean that clearly is the case. At the same time, you can point to what we just talked about. At the same time that all this was going on, we also were a culture that was becoming more and more in debt, and people, especially those in the middle class, were leveraging more and more, and it ultimately, I think, backfired on a lot of people that they began to live a lifestyle that really was not realistic.
This happened. Mansions. I mean, it was great fun while it lasted, but it didn't last in perpetuity. It's ended, and we're suffering the pain of that now.
All right, we're going to come back and talk some more about these allegations that Matt Taibbi has made in several articles in Rolling Stone. Highly entertaining articles with an extreme bias and I think lots of exaggerations and inaccuracies, but fun to read nonetheless. We're coming back in just a second. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the U.S. National Whitewater Center, featuring the Coca-Cola 4th of July Festival, July 3rd and 4th. Fireworks and live music from Tab Benoit, Eric Lindell, and more. Details at usnwc.org. Well, the job of the Charlotte Fire Department is to put out fires. But if you talk to some of the fire people there, they will tell you they don't do so much of that anymore because of new building codes and the like. What they are doing, of course, is acting as first responders, and they also help keep people safe during floods, which are common in many parts of the county. So on Monday at 9, we're going to talk to Charlotte Fire Chief John Hannon about the department, a day in the life of a firefighter, their training, and more. That's Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Pretty News Roundup, you'll hear top journalists give meaning to the week's national headlines. Take a look back at what happened, how it affects your world. The Friday News Roundup. Join us.
Join Diane for the News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about banks. Are they too big to fail, too criminal to fail? With Dr. Tony Plath, professor of banking at UNC Charlotte. Rick Rothaker is a banking reporter with Reuters. And Adam O'Daniel is the finance editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. A lot of these banks grew and grew in the 90s and 2000s. And in Charlotte, the two big banks grew under the tutelage of Hugh McCall and Ed Crutchfield. And then they retired, and newcomers, the two Kens, came into the picture. And that's when things went awry. Is that to say that had Hugh McCall and Ed Crutchfield stayed in charge of those banks, that things would not have gone awry?
It's hard to speculate the answer to that question, but I think, you know, you can argue that they are two outsized personalities in the industry, and they knew their companies well. They understood their histories, where they'd come from, how they'd grown. And it's really difficult to replace that kind of talent with a new generation of managers that can keep all those plates spinning and make more spin at the same time. So the direct answer to your question is their extraordinary personalities and abilities shaped the industry and shaped Charlotte. And that's really hard to sustain with another team of managers that follow them. Mm-hmm. And that's when things started to get out of control. Now, having said that, you know, at the same time, McCall and Crutchfield, you know, were in charge of those companies in an era when we didn't have the problem in Europe. We didn't have the problem with unemployment. We didn't have the problem with debt and over-leveraging. So they lived in a much kinder economic environment.
Okay.
I'd say this story when the two Kens came in initially actually was that these are the guys who need to kind of knit together all these sweeping operations that have been put together by Hugh McCall and Ed Crutchfield. And initially there was a sort of a calmness of sort of making these machines work better. And then they kind of got back into the acquisition game again, which they learned from Hugh McCall and Ed Crutchfield. And you know, some of those deals didn't work out as well as they would have liked. So I think they kind of continued some of that legacy, but they also inherited companies that were getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and then, of course, the whole broader economic environment that we're now in.
And it was the acquisition of Countrywide and later Merrill Lynch that got Bank of America into the trouble that it finds itself in today, I suppose. And although somehow I think I knew this because I've done so many interviews with you, Rick, and other people who have written books about this period in our history, that the Bank of America knew about the true nature of the troubled assets at Merrill Lynch before the merger went through. I think I knew this, and yet it was in the paper the other day that it's been revealed that Ken Lewis knew and didn't tell his shareholders the truth.
Yeah, it's been written about and talked about before, and there's been other lawsuits about this, and that was one of the big issues that emerged in 2009 after the Merrill Lynch deal closed. Was we soon started to find out that Bank of America was going to buy Merrill Lynch and then started getting cold feet. And then the further story that the government put some pressure on them to make sure they went through, because this was this time of systemic risk where if they didn't do the deal, the whole financial system would come down.
Exactly. If you believe the story, that side of the story, it is that Hank Paulson, then the Secretary of the Treasury, said, if you don't do this deal with Merrill Lynch, there won't be a Ken Lewis at Bank of America, because he could yank him out of the chair. So he did the deal and then didn't tell the stockholders. And he says he didn't tell the stockholders that the assets were more troubled than they thought they were, because he was relying on the advice of experts, attorneys in the field, who told him it wasn't necessary to reveal these greater than anticipated losses. And people who are in his corner say he did the right thing, because a CEO is supposed to rely on expert advice. Wow.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the big question is, you know, they had December 5th, 2008, they had the shareholder meeting to approve the deal. A couple days beforehand, they started seeing that the losses are building and building. And so should they have told shareholders about that? You know, these losses can go up and down. Obviously, they weren't going down at the time. But, you know, you talk to your lawyers to say, is this something we have to, you know, they obviously don't give us an update every day on the finances of the company. They do it every quarter. Do they have to tell everyone about this before they vote? Suppose the advice was they shouldn't, although some executives inside the bank said they felt they should.
One of the lawyers got fired.
That's right. There was Tim Mayopoulos, who was the general counsel at the time. There's some investigations and some lawsuits that have revealed that Tim actually said, we need to talk about this. This might be something we need to disclose. And within 24 hours of that, he was fired.
The $64,000 question here is, why would one of the top securities law firms in the country recommend to the bank that they not disclose material financial information in advance of a shareholder vote? I don't know why Wachtell gave that advice to Ken Lewis, but that advice was wrong. They should have disclosed. It was material information.
Pressure from the government, perhaps?
Could be. It could be that they were acting under advice from the Secretary of the Treasury. We don't know. But, boy, I'd like to know the answer to that question.
But even if you are an executive, take Bank of America out of this. You're the head guy of a flooring company that has stockholders, and you've just acquired another flooring company. And you've discovered behind the scenes that the other flooring company has troubled assets, but you don't tell your shareholders because your attorneys tell you you don't have to. You stand up in a public meeting and you lie. What makes that right?
Well, you mischaracterize it. You don't lie. You just don't fully disclose. Should you have fully disclosed? I think the answer to that is yes.
It's a sin of omission.
Yes. But if you're outside counsel and you're sitting next to me and you say you don't have to disclose this information and you shouldn't disclose it, what are you likely to do? That's the dilemma that Ken faced.
Right.
And he had 2 days to answer that question. Remember, this all transpired between December 5th and December 8th. So what happened in New York where outside counsel, and remember, we're not talking about a small law firm in Nebraska. These guys are top securities lawyers. Why did they tell him he didn't have to disclose?
Well, is that an indication that something is rotten in Denmark throughout the entire financial system?
Well, in this case, this is going to be litigated out. You know, was this good advice? Should it have been disclosed? And
Evidently, a settlement will come or not come from it.
This is a question to you guys in the media. Doesn't the law firm have a responsibility to disclose publicly why they rendered that opinion?
Well, I think that's going to be an issue in the case, is that you're going to have to argue malpractice or that it was good advice. And so,
A settlement came down yesterday. On this, at least one of the two settlements, it was announced that Bank of America's directors reached a definitive settlement of litigation by shareholders on this matter. The judge in the case refused to reveal the terms, but it is expected to total $20 million. The suit was against bank directors, including Ken Lewis, former CEO. There will be yet another suit against the bank itself, and the judge says that he may delay final approval of the settlement that was reached yesterday, citing the need to decide whether certain damages can be recovered in the class action case or the director case, the scope of insurance coverage for directors, and desire to better understand the facts. Let's talk about those three things. The need to decide whether damages can be recovered in one case or the other. Why is that even a consideration? If you're sued by two separate entities and both entities are judged to be eligible for damages, pay them.
If wrongdoing can be confirmed and if it's found that the bank acted incorrectly, but the bank's defense is that it relied on the advice of outside counsel. So, I'm not questioning their motive. I'm questioning why did outside counsel tell them what to do?
Okay. Can the outside counsel be sued?
Good question.
Find out.
The other thing is, aren't they still under a fraud indictment out of the state of New York? I mean, you reported that in February. I haven't heard the end of that.
This case is sort of a private case brought by shareholders. And, you know, like you said, Mike, you've heard about these allegations before.
Right.
Attorney General of New York at the time, Andrew Cuomo, he dug into a lot of this because it started with the whole bonus situation that Merrill Lynch was being bought and then suddenly was paying out these bonuses,
right,
which then kind of unfolded a lot of the backstory of what was really going on here with this acquisition. And so a lot of those allegations were in that case, and that case is still out there as well and takes on Ken Lewis and Joe Price and the bank.
And that's not a civil case. That's basically a criminal case, is it not?
That's civil, actually, it's brought by the state as opposed to, shareholders of the company.
So the second point that the judge made in terms of delaying the decision on this, the scope of insurance coverage for the directors. Why is that a consideration?
Because I think it goes to the idea of personal liability beyond the extent of the D&O, the directors and officers insurance policy that indemnifies them against certain kinds of risk. And so essentially what they're doing, again, that's legal gobbledygook, but what that does is go to whether or not they should be held personally liable or whether or not their insurance that they gain as directors should cover them.
And the insurance is bought for them by the corporation.
That's correct.
They don't have to pay the premiums, right? If they are found liable in this case, which they were evidently, they're going to pay a fine. What does it matter whether their insurance company can pay for it or whether they have to pay for it themselves? They are directors of a corporation that evidently made a mistake. Why aren't they liable?
Well, if they violated the good faith rule, if they violated the business judgment rule, they can be held personally accountable in excess of what the D&O policy would pay them. And that in turn exposes them personally to much more financial risk than if the D&O policy covers
them. So what?
Them.
I mean, if you're on the board of directors for a company and you're doing something that you know to be wrong, why shouldn't you be held responsible?
You should.
I mean, corporations are people, after all. The Supreme Court said so. Let's see here. The third point is a desire to better understand the facts. Now, the judge just went through this whole case. What is there to understand?
Well, I think what I interpret from that is just the judge saying, hold the phone. You know, we're not going to rule on this immediately. You know, the judge wants to take some time, look over this, because it is very complex. I mean, we are
trying to nail Jell-O to the wall.
Yeah,
here,
exactly.
Are we not?
You know, it's a really tough thing to discern what exactly is going on. And I think that statement just means
Bottom and find out why management and the board were advised not to disclose material financial information 2 days ahead of the vote. That's the question I want answered. And I don't know the answer to that question, which is why I'm hedging everything else.
Okay. Does the court want to know the answer to that question?
Well, I think we've got multiple suits going on here. So I think in one of those cases, I think they're waiting to see the outcome of another case. So sometimes they want to sort of settle everything all at once.
Is this just Bank of America, or are there other banks in similar situations at the moment?
Oh, let's see. JPMC in a $2 billion loss that might be a $5 billion loss, and they might have unloaded the positions, and they might not have unloaded the positions, and it might have been hedging, and it might have been speculating. I mean, what a mess that is. I mean, it's a similar mess to this, although, you know, it's more recent. Look at Citi and the problems that Citicorp has had. So, you know, the answer to the question is all of these big financial institutions are really, really difficult to manage because they are so big.
Well, Hugh McCall told me once that there are very few people in the world who could manage these companies.
I would argue that there may be no one in the world that can manage them.
And
the government certainly can't regulate them. Look at the mistakes the OCC made at JPMC.
So isn't that an indictment against having these big banks? What's wrong with, as NCNB used to say, we want to be the best bank in the neighborhood? What's wrong with having...
That was a long time ago.
It's a long time ago. But what's wrong with being the best bank in the neighborhood?
Absolutely nothing. That's why community banking, you know, the community banks are gaining deposits hand over fist right now. I mean, you know, there is an exodus from the big banks to the smaller banks and the credit unions.
Is that in reaction to TARP, or is that in reaction to the way they're treated as customers?
I think that's a public reaction to the fact that people have vilified big banks. There's a lot of anger out there about where we are today economically and with the job market, and a lot of people blame the big banks. You know, that's what the Rolling Stone piece was all about, for causing it.
Earlier on this program, a couple of months ago, you said, Tony, that banks should not be putting federally insured deposits at risk when they make investments that have risks. That any failure should be borne by the bank and its shareholders, not depositors or the federal government.
Amen.
How are they doing that right now? How are they putting deposits at risk?
Well, that goes to the new, you know, Office of Financial Stability and the Dodd-Frank Act and the living wills that banks are required to come up with, the additional capital that's required under that, and the fact that, you know, banks are being held to a standard of accountability where the FDIC and the other regulators are saying, we are not going to bail you out. We will protect the financial system, but if any individual institution requires government money, we're not going to allow that to happen. We will fail the holding company and in turn turn the bank over to new owners. The shareholders walk away with nothing. You know, you can't socialize the losses and privatize the gains, which is what we've done over the course of the federal safety net from 1933 to 2007. We got to change that.
But we didn't have these problems until 2000.
We didn't have banks that were $2 trillion banks in 1970 and 1980 and 1990.
When you're in a world market, which we are in, and you're competing against these banks in Europe and banks in China and banks elsewhere, can you survive in the United States of America without these enormous banks being able to do worldwide business at the drop of a hat?
Well, I think that's one of the arguments you'll hear from the banking industry, is that when General Electric needs a loan, they can't go to the local neighborhood community bank. They need a big, large world bank. And do you want that bank to be in the United States, or do you want it to be in Germany? And so, you know, I think that's, for certainly from the industry, they'll say there's a purpose for these big banks. And but of course, when things go awry, the problems are magnified.
But that's one of the reasons Hugh McCall said on this program, as a matter of fact, and he said it in his book, the reason he wanted to build Nations Bank into the Bank of America was because he was tired of going to New York hat in hand to get money. He wanted to be the person that people came to for the
money.
But
these big banks don't have to invest federally insured, taxpayer-backed deposits in risky activities. Just segregate that part of the bank and say, look, if you want federal deposit insurance, you're going to have to invest in treasury securities and limit the investments to treasury securities. Segregate that part of the business so the taxpayer isn't exposed to the loss of the size of these institutions and the scope of their business.
Why hasn't that been done? In whatever occurred.
Well, it is being done. I mean, that's the whole purpose of Dodd-Frank. That's the whole purpose.
But Dodd-Frank, evidently, when you read articles about Dodd-Frank, they say it's toothless, not going to happen.
Here's the bottom question. The bottom line question is, can you separate systemic risk from the risk to an individual institution? You've got a $2.5 trillion institution in JPMC and in Bank of America. Can you, in turn, carve out the institution from the system and differentiate between the two? You know, the government says yes. The people that argue that Dodd-Frank won't work say no. Those two things are inseparable.
A couple of things that have come in over the transom while we've been talking about this. J.D. writes, Ken Lewis and others say they were acting on the advice of lawyers. Wow. Every time in capital letters, given the chance to come clean and tell the truth or fully disclose, which is lying, that they did the wrong thing. Following the advice of lawyers, isn't that what all priests and bishops in the Catholic Church and Penn State folks say they do? Why are all the top institutions and leaders more concerned about themselves than about doing the right thing?
But in all honesty, what do you want him to do? Do you want him to counter the advice of counsel and go to his shareholders and say, hey, I ignored the advice of my attorneys? Think of the lawsuits that would expose the bank to. I mean, if you're advised by outside counsel, which is supposed to be unbiased with respect to a course of corporate action, and you don't take that advice, aren't you then subject to a suit for breach?
Very good point.
Well, it's going to be a big issue. I mean, they're out on the line to see if they should have disclosed or not.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more of this and get into some of the allegations that Matt Taibbi makes in these series of articles in Rolling Stone magazine about big banks and particularly about Bank of America. When we come back, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hands for Hire weatherization experts, offering home energy audits, providing energy efficient improvements like eliminating crawl space moisture using a closed crawl space system, preventing mold. Details and appointments, handsforhire.com. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, a panel of journalists joins guest host Terrence Smith for analysis of the week's top national news stories. A House panel voted to hold Attorney General Eric Holder in contempt of Congress. Republican presidential hopeful Mitt Romney told a Latino group he would replace and supersede President Barack Obama's immigration plan. Federal Reserve officials extend the program known as Operation Twist and say they are prepared to do more if necessary to spur job growth. Just some of the topics they'll be covering at 10. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323. 800-603-WFAE or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
On the next Radio Lab, what's going on inside our guts?
25 feet of coiled, soiled, fetid, tube of corned beef.
Meat and bread and coffee.
Salt. Pastrami sandwich.
Mini burgers.
It's steamy.
I don't know, it's like bubbly.
Kind of disgusting.
But fascinating.
Thousands of species that are living inside of you and preying on each other.
The mysteries of the human gut, this week on Radiolab.
That's tonight at 8 at 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Adam O'Daniels with us, finance editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Rick Rothacker, banking reporter for Reuters. And Dr. Tony Plaff, professor of banking at UNC Charlotte. We're talking about big banks, Bank of America, and the situation that we are in. In March, Matt Taibbi wrote a searing article in Rolling Stone magazine, which I have said was marvelously entertaining and factually inaccurate. But boy, it's fun to read. And also, he leaps to some conclusions that I find specious at best. But nonetheless, we'll go through this article a little bit. He says the article was headlined, Bank of America Too Crooked to Fail, which alleged the bank has defrauded everyone from investors and insurers to homeowners and the unemployed. He alleged they try to rig global interest rates, which I think is the LIBOR he's talking about.
Yes.
And appointed to the $137 million fine imposed for bilking needy schools and cities and the plan to suck multiple fees out of the unemployment checks of jobless workers. This, I believe, happened in Georgia, where if you were on unemployment, you were given a Bank of America debit card to remove money from your account, and if you didn't use it at a Bank of America ATM, you were charged fees. He points to those things and more as indications that the bank is out of control. Fair, or is there something to be said about that?
Well, he definitely lays out a lot of allegations. I remember doing a story in early 2008 where we added up that Wachovia and Bank of America had had $1 billion in fines, government fines, over a five-year period, and that seems kind of quaint now to only have $1 billion of fines in 5 years. It's you can't even really keep track of them all.
Is that
now.
Because it's cheaper to do the wrong thing and pay the fine if you're caught than it is to do the right thing?
Well, part of it is the reality of how this works. You go about your business. You're trying to do the right thing. People make mistakes, and you get fined afterwards. And you probably made more. You're going to make more money than the fine, so you move on.
Yeah, this is not a defense of wrongdoing by a bank or any other large corporation. But like Rick said, I mean, this company has 288,000 employees, more than $2 trillion in assets. It does business all over the world. People are going to make mistakes. When you're dealing with that many people and that many lines of business, there will be at some point a law broken, a regulation broken, and it's cheaper rather than try to get up to the bottom of every single little issue. It's cheaper to pay the fine, settle the lawsuit, and move on with your business. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but that's the way it works.
And this is classic confirmation bias. If you start with the bias that Bank of America is the corporate antichrist of the world, then you find the facts that selectively support that opinion. And that's exactly what this guy did. And, Bank of America is damned if they do and damned if they don't. In this article, on page one, he criticizes them for profiteering, and on page eight, he criticizes them for not making enough money. Well, how do you have both at the same time?
Exactly right. Taibbi alleges that Bank of America and its subsidiaries, Countrywide Mortgage and Merrill Lynch, pioneered ways to sell, quote, toxic pools of mortgages to suckers. B of A, he says, when peddling these mortgages as investments to unions and state pension funds, promised in writing that all its loans had passed due diligence tests and met high internal standards. It promised that if any of the loans in the mortgage pool turned out to be defective or in default, it would buy them back. And it assured customers that if all else failed, the pools of mortgages were all insured. If that is true, if they did all of those things.
Oh, that's true.
Well, then why isn't somebody in prison?
Well, that's a good question. Why isn't Al Mozillo and the people at Countrywide, who made tons of documentary errors, not more subject to attack and criticism? Remember, B of A has a loan portfolio of 13 million mortgages. 1 million of those loans were Bank of America-originated loans. 12 million were Countrywide loans. And that Countrywide loan book was a snake pit There were all kinds of errors in that book. And essentially, after the purchase, Bank of America was responsible for cleaning all of that up.
So then why isn't somebody in jail or even been prosecuted for this kind of conduct? Why?
We're not at the end of this yet.
If you make promises that you don't keep.
Let's talk about robo-signing, you know, because essentially robo-signing is perjury. If you and I did what the banks did and, signing an affidavit that swore that they had the note or that they'd seen a promissory note in a foreclosure and we'd never seen the note, that's perjury. So why haven't we attacked that more directly? I mean, there are some fair questions that go to your question.
Let me ask the reporters, why hasn't the media been more dogged, like Matt Taibbi is here, in pursuing this in a fairer venue? And why haven't people been prosecuted?
I think it's one of the big questions from the financial crisis. It's been written about a lot by everybody. I think that question comes up a lot of why hasn't anyone
gone to jail? Has the Wall Street Journal written about it?
Have
they been quiet about it?
New York Times has done stories. I'd say a lot of, almost every news agency has done a story saying how come there hasn't been more.
Why can't we get an answer?
One reason is these cases are complicated. You bring in there's actually been cases at the Bear Stearns hedge fund. They actually brought, indictments and they ended up not being convicted because you start getting into court and this is very, complicated stuff. You have to prove intent to defraud. So they're not easy cases. The section you brought up there gets into this, the loans were made and then they're packaged into securities for investors. And, that's kind of the latest round of area that's really being investigated. Well, and there's a task force that the government has and things like that.
There's another answer to your question. Remember the $26 billion settlement that was just reached a few months ago with the state attorneys general, the 50 state attorneys general, essentially granted the banks immunity from prosecution on the robo-signing issue. So why isn't someone in jail? Because the government has chosen in many cases not to prosecute.
Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think just to throw this out there, these acts were committed over years and years. And so to investigate all of them will take years and years to get to the bottom. If you want to bring charges and see people go to jail and all that, it takes years and years. Is there the political will to cross election terms, cross administrations, investigate all this? Or is it easier to stand up and wave a flag of a $26 billion fine?
Or is it easier to serve corporations versus the electorate? Because corporations are funding these political campaigns,
not the
people.
Yeah, and if you saw Jamie Dimon in front of the Senate Banking Committee, you could really tell that they were a big funder of many of those Senate Republicans.
Well, what about that? Is that why we're not seeing these prosecutions? Is that why the government is being timid on this? Because they know that where their bread is buttered?
Well, certainly a fair question. I think it's one that has to be asked. I don't know the answer in every single senator's case or what their individual motivations are, but you're right. I mean, the J.P. Morgan hearing where Jamie Dimon was on Capitol Hill,
I thought Jim DeMint was going to start asking for stock tips.
There was at one point our senator here from North Carolina, Kay Hagan, apologized and told Jamie Dimon, "Of course, I wouldn't want you to tell us anything that you don't want to tell us." Essentially, and it was just a little bit laughable at some of the questions.
There's another question at work here, and that is: does singling out someone for punishment, the public wants somebody to fry for all of this? Does that change the unemployment rate? Does that change our rate of economic growth?
No.
Does that restore solvency to Europe? I mean, we've got far bigger fish to fry right now than sticking a fork in the banks.
One of the things that Taibbi does say here that I think is probably accurate, even though he does it with, I think, a bias, he says that the fact that Bank of America and other banks on Wall Street knowingly inflating the bubble by engaging in rampant mortgage fraud and then profiting from the collapse by devising ways to shift losses to pension funds, in other words, selling these bad loans that they knew were bad to pension funds.
Yeah, but
he says it resulted in one of the biggest reverse transfers of wealth in history from pensioners to financiers. Now, do we want this to happen again,
or do we want
to go after these guys and make an example of them?
Once we get the economy on a firmer footing, then we start to get to the bottom of
who
did what.
We'll forget. This is America. We have short memories.
We need to remember.
Okay. Conga Chili, one of our email contributors, writes, Matt Taibbi has done some of the best reporting on the financial scamming of America by Wall Street and the banksters, and has another story coming out in the July 5th issue of Rolling Stone. Meanwhile, Congress is wasting our time by grilling sports stars about drugs, doing absolutely nothing about virtually anything, and fawning over Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan, asking his advice on how they should regulate him. The biggest transfer of wealth in the history of the country is taking place, but not from wealthy to the poor, as conservatives would have us believe, but from the 99% to the most powerful and connected. Matt Taibbi might be over the top in his rhetoric, but he is spot on in his accusations of the outright thievery going on in our financial institutions.
I completely disagree. Why? If you want to believe that Bank of America is the corporate antichrist, nothing I'm going to say is going to change your opinion. I'm not an apologist for the bank. The bank made mistakes. They did a lot of things wrong. But at the end of the day, we need banks. I mean, where are you going to get a mortgage? Where are you going to have a deposit account? Where are you going to get investment advice? How are you going to send your kids to college? There's a role in this society for financial institutions. And, you know, the greed in the system wasn't limited to the banks. The insurance companies, the regulators, I mean, the borrowers that were buying more home than they could afford on a minimum payment that they couldn't fully make were all responsible for this. So didn't Walt Kelly say, I've looked in the mirror and the enemy is us?
Yeah,
we're all guilty.
But I think the people who bought more house than they could afford and had it foreclosed on have been hurt. Because
they stopped making their loan payments.
Yes, but they've been hurt because they have terrible credit. They probably lost their house in some. But the people who ran Merrill Lynch, I've forgotten his name. Thane.
John Thane.
John Thane. I don't think he's suffering.
Adam said a minute ago, we're not at the end of this. We haven't reached the bottom of this yet. Al Mazzello hasn't been hurt from this either. You know, as I say, but we talked earlier about the fact that, you know, Ken Lewis is still under indictment in the state of New York. I mean, we haven't fully litigated and gotten to the bottom of everything that happened in the industry, and
certainly people will be
held accountable.
But have we done anything substantial to discourage this from happening again? But
the Basel III
does
agreement.
Does it work? Will it work? Has it worked?
Well, we don't know. I mean, that's one of the reasons why people are so upset is we've passed these, you know, Dodd-Frank, half of the rules related to that have yet to be written, and people are just questioning, is it all going to work? Well, I don't know. I don't think anyone really knows if it's going to work.
So, Tony, how can some of it work and some of it won't.
Tony, I mean, we're going to have to go back and revise.
How can you point to Dodd-Frank when, as Adam says, half of the rules haven't
You asked, haven't we done something? And the answer is yes, we've done a lot, but we haven't fully implemented all of the things that we've done. We've written the law. We haven't written the regulation that follows the law. So, as I say, we're in the process of making those changes now. But it's a sweeping, systemic change to the entire financial system. You know, we're not dotting I's and crossing T's. We're rewriting all of bank law right now. That's really hard to do.
Mike, you made the comment a moment ago about people who took a mortgage they couldn't afford, that they've paid the price. They've, you know, lost the home. Their credit rating has been ruined. Why haven't, you know, the Ken Lewis's of the world paid the price? You know, the individual CEOs, I think, some of them are still under investigation. Some of them probably have gotten off a little bit easier than a lot of us would like to see. But I think we're also missing the point that shareholders of these big companies, like Bank of America, the shareholders that really own the company, they have suffered greatly because of the decisions of that bank. They have lost millions and millions of dollars through the declining share price, the losses from quarter to quarter. And so, you know, you could make the argument that the owners of these large companies have absolutely paid quite a price for the decisions
they made. Look at the Wachovia shareholders, to go to your point. That's a good point.
But the shareholders of these companies, who are the quote-unquote owners of these companies, who have everything from, what, 5 shares to several million shares, may be hurt by declining stock prices, but the heads of the head guys who make these decisions have not been hurt. They're still walking away from these banks with millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Agreed.
And maybe they're under indictment, but they're living a lavish lifestyle.
Agreed.
Yeah, there's no argument there. I just think we have to be careful to say that the only people that have been hurt are the, you know, the mortgage borrowers. There's a lot of people, even wealthy folks, that invested in these companies.
And to go to your question, management should be held accountable for their actions, you know, in stronger terms than they have been to date.
R.C. writes, one, as any banker As any banker will tell you, getting legal opinions is like having somebody testify in court. You never ask a question you don't know the answer to. Two, the real danger of the downgrades is the trillions of dollars in cash immediately due on most, if not all, derivative transactions. In plain language, all the losses we already knew about just escalated exponentially. And three, many of these scams aren't really that complicated. Ask Rick about the municipal derivatives thieves who cheated on billions of auctions at Starbucks on Trade Street. Do you know this guy?
I might. He's talking about there, you know, and I think it comes up in the Rolling Stone article that some of the victims of some of these problems have been municipalities that have, you know, invested in complex derivative transactions that sounded great at the time, that, you know, the sure, local bonds are going to, you know, have a good low prices and good returns for the communities and help raise money. And we've found out that there was some bid rigging going on here, and agreements were made between banks. You bid on this one, I'll bid on that one to get the best rates. And we've seen Bank of America get in trouble and a bunch of other banks get in trouble on this. And that whole issue is still kind of unfolding.
That's precisely what's wrong with these large concentrations of financial power in the hands of two or three companies within our economy. The American system was designed deliberately, purposefully, to keep banks small, so we wouldn't have these large concentrations of financial and political power in the hands of a couple of companies. Now, the counterargument to that is, well, we won't be competitive in global finance, right? But at the same time, there's a downside. There's a detrimental effect on the economy when we concentrate so much money in so few companies.
Well, the other thing is that the whole state of the government was designed by the founding fathers to be slow-moving and deliberative, and that puts us at a disadvantage economically when we try to compete in the world, because we have political gridlock. We don't have an oil policy. We're in the middle of rewriting the banking policy, and it takes years for this to happen when meanwhile the world is moving.
And it takes years to sort out all the details. It's incredibly difficult to completely change the financial system at a quick pace.
Are we being held hostage by these big banks? Because we can't let them fail.
They made a lot of mistakes that they're going to have to account for. But at the end of the day, we need banks. So, you know, how do you resolve those two issues at the same time? I think one way is you limit taxpayer risk. Another way is you limit the size and the scope of these institutions. That'll help.
Tony Plath, professor of banking at UNC Charlotte. Rick Rothacker, a banking reporter for Reuters. And Adam O'Daniel, finance editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.